Everybody loves chalupas. Everybody knows it's true. If you want to have chalupas, baby, I know what to do. This is Rish Outfield, and you have the unfortunate task of listening to the Rish Outcast. The other day I was reading about the Jackson 5, and that their Motown contract entitled them to 2% of every album sale. And I thought about that. So, you know, if they sold $100 worth of albums, they got to keep two of those $100 split amongst the Jackson 5 and their father. I mean, technically, probably it all went to their father. But still, 2%. Huh. So, I got it good, folks. I get to keep a significantly bigger chunk of all the cash that's just rolling in for the Rish Outcast. Although, you know, it's possible I'm making about the same amount as Tito Jackson did in 1974. Anyhow, the other day I got on here and I started to record, and I was going to present a story, and then I was at a loss. I was like, oh, what happened? That was a story? This is at the very tail end of Big Anklevich and I getting together on Mondays. I mean, right now we are at the end of the tail end. We are at the rattle on the end of the tail of Big and I getting together. But I was driving toward his place, and it's a tradition that I Rish Outcast, and I was like, what? I can't remember what the story was. And what it was that the night before, I started to record something called Library Week, and everything on my computer kept freezing. Even MS Word, which I was reading the document off of, was freezing. And I got to tell you, I mean, MS Word is a basic word processing document. Maybe not basic, but compared to a game or an audio editing program or even Firefox, it's basic. And for it to be freezing, well, it was just frustrating. There was a lot of cursing and then pausing and then saying, come on! And so I didn't get it recorded. And then the next day I went to Biggs and I ended up having nothing to record about. But now it's been more than a week, I guess. And I thought I would share with you Library Week. Now, this is a story that Big suggested we do on the Doonstief. But times are real tough for the Doonstief right now. I mean, I've gone into it a little bit before. I don't know that I want to go into it now. Hopefully things will be better once Big is resettled in a new city and his life is different and the Doonstief may become a priority again. I don't know. If not, well, there's lots more Rish Outcasts where this one came from. But I figured, you know, hell with it. I'm just going to record Library Week and present it to you guys. So maybe I'll just go ahead and do that. Oh, but I'll give you two warnings. First, this story is incredibly dated. That's why I agreed to do it on the Doonstief, is so that we could talk about how dated it had become in just a short time. I still think that would be a really good conversation. The other warning is, I guess I was going to warn you that there was an F word in there, but, oh, you know, I don't have an explicit warning on the Rish Outcast. It just occurred to me, we always did it on the Doonstief, because even if we were not offensive, even if we didn't say words like jamblies on the show, we just wanted to be covered. But I never even thought to do that on the Outcast. Well, it's too late now. So, Library Week, dated. Enjoy.
Library Week. Written and narrated by Rish Outfield. It was David's weekend with the kids. Back when this whole thing started, he had drawn up a schedule and magneted it to the fridge. Even weekends were library weeks, and odd weekends were video weeks. This was a library week, and David had a copy of the Kapler Superman book to return to the library. But the kids claimed they hadn't finished their books and wanted to go to the video store instead. It was really trying to go anywhere with Michael and Brianne. Brianne, because she was ridiculously clingy and dependent, seemingly more vulnerable at 7 than she had been as an infant. Left alone or out of David's sight for longer than the length of a bathroom break, and she would become teary-eyed, paranoid, or extremely loud. But Bree was a Stepford child compared to Michael. Not to put too fine a point on it, or any point, he had become a little bastard. Angry, resentful, bitter and foul-mouthed, he had reached, at age 9, a level of disrespect that David hadn't reached as a teenager. Still, he tried to connect with him. After all, Michael was his only son, and had once been the pride of his days. Even now, glowering and borderline feral, he looked a great deal like his old man, even though David was now rapidly losing his hair and constantly squinting, and almost exactly as the elder had looked as a boy. David had promised himself he'd never spank his son, much less slug him one. His own father was a former Marine with a nasty temper, and once, when he was 7, he took a drunken wallop to the mouth, and it broke off a loose tooth. His mother shrieked and threw his father out for almost a week. So when Mike acted like Attila the Hun Jr. instead of David Hicks's son, he'd count to 10. If that didn't work, he'd leave the room. Just now, counting seemed to be working. "All right, let's hit the video store."
"Yay!"
Brianne said, clapping her hands.
"Is that all right with you, Mike?"
"Whatever,"
Mike said, miles from caring. They loaded up into Dad's Saturn, heading toward Center Street.
"Seat belts," Dad said.
Mike purposely left his off, and his father didn't press the issue. They parked the car outside Video Cityo, and the boy groaned.
"Not this crappy video store. Why can't we go to Hollywood?"
"I don't like the people there," David said. "Too corporate. The way they robotically greet you at the door. You know what I mean?"
"Yeah,"
Brianne agreed.
"You can tell they don't mean it."
Appreciating his daughter's support, David opened the car door.
"The owners here know my name."
"Whoopee,"
Mike said under his breath. But he followed them out of the car and into the store. Sure enough, the fat Indian woman taping up a Shrek poster on the window smiled at them and said,
"Nice to see you. Dave, right?"
"Right."
He grinned at his son, who scowled right back at him.
"Well, it's a stupid name for a video store."
"No argument there," Dave admitted.
He then proposed they rent Back to the Future and watch it together.
"That movie sucks,"
Michael said. But David got the impression he would have said it no matter what his father suggested.
"Have you ever seen it?"
"Yes, and it's crap."
David's first inclination was to smack the boy, but he stifled it. Somehow.
"It's my favorite movie. You got your name from its star, Mike."
"I don't want to see it, okay?"
"Okay."
David looked down at his daughter, who was holding onto his belt strap.
"How about you, honey? What would you like to watch?"
"What a girl wants,"
she said, not requiring thought.
"But we got that last time."
"No, we didn't." "She watches that all the time,"
Michael said, shuffling through the previously viewed racks.
"Mom bought her the DVD. "Shut up,"
she said, but weakly. She was busted.
"Hey, hey," her father said softly. Isn't there a new release you'd like to check out?
They cost more,
she said. And it was true. That doesn't matter. Does something look good? She looked pained. Before she could answer, David said, Look again, okay? Or we can ask an employee what they recommend.
No way,
Mike responded, though the statement had not been aimed at him.
People here have dots on their forehead.
Jealous? David asked. And Bree giggled.
Daddy, why would he want a dot on his head? Why would anybody?
Mike muttered. And Dave didn't answer his question. He didn't know. He turned to his son, who was brooding while perusing the popcorn, sodas, and junk food. Mike, can you just go quietly and pick something, please?
Nope,
he said, as though proud of his insolence. His father looked at his watch. The weekend had barely started, and he was already ready for Monday morning. David stepped over to the classics section, glancing up and down the shelves. There were a lot of great movies here. Bringing Up Baby, The African Queen, The Grapes of Wrath, Holiday Inn, Laura, The Philadelphia Story, Strangers on a Train, 12 Angry Men. He'd love to rent a couple and just fall asleep to a quality, classy black-and-white movie tonight. He wondered if his kids were old enough to appreciate Casablanca. Actually, Mike may have been too old to appreciate it, in a twisted way. Brianne had taken 3 steps away. Now she stopped and turned around again. Honey, David said, scarcely concealing his exasperation.
What was I named after, Daddy?
I don't know. Your mother named you, he said, then regretted it. Just because the woman was a monstrous witch now didn't mean she had always been. And she'd given him 2 wonderful children. Okay, 1. Mike started to walk past them, a smug expression on his face.
Maybe I'll get Dishonored Sword again.
David grimaced. The Vin Diesel samurai movie. He hated Vin Diesel. Partly because he was a monosyllabic troll who made Stallone look like Albert Schweitzer. Partly because something about him reminded him of his father. Can we pass on that, please?
Can we pass on you, please?
1, 2. That had nudity in it, remembered David.
Prude,
Mike growled, with enough rancor to fuel a terrorist cell. 3, 4. That's enough. We're not renting it. The boy would not be beaten.
I'll just download it when I get home.
5, 6. Well, you're not home yet.
Wish I was, faggot.
Had he called his own father a faggot? Moreover, was that word even used anymore? It wasn't something you heard every day. If you didn't run in troglodyte circles, that is. Okay, that's it. Say 1 more word, and we're out of here. The boy looked his old man in the eye, and before he could blink, said,
1 more word.
What little patience David had left evaporated into the air. He grabbed both of his children and left Video Cityo. The bearded man at the checkout counter raised his hand and said, Have a good night, as they walked out. Right outside the door, Bree began to keen.
That's not fair, Daddy.
I'm sorry, honey, he said. You can watch one of my movies.
Your movies suck,
Mike said. Big shock. You suck, their dad growled, then regretted it. It would get back to his ex, and trouble would surely follow. They got into the car. Seat belts, David said. Automatically.
Can't we go to the library?
Brianne pleaded. David started the engine. You didn't want to go.
I do now. You said it was a library week. Please?
David glanced at the Saturn's clock. They would be cutting it close. His good friend Max worked there. Essentially the same guy he'd been in high school, Max Wierzbowski never married, and worked at the library in the afternoons and evenings for $7 an hour. It let him read the books and play role-playing games, and work on the alternate history novel he was never going to write. David hadn't seen Max in more than a week, but had talked to him on the phone. Max had been all excited the other day about some obscure book he had discovered in the boiler room under the library. Max was weird that way, but it could actually be endearing. It would be nice to see him again.
Okay, we're going to go visit Uncle Max.
He's not our uncle,
Mike said from the back seat.
I love Uncle Max,
the girl said.
He's cool.
Cooler than you,
Mike added.
Hey, David said softly. Brienne's very cool.
I wasn't talking to her.
David then considered saying, Uncle Max lives in a squalid one-room apartment and never sees the sun. He collects figurines of dragons as an adult. The only breasts he sees regularly are on turkey and mustard sandwiches. But he didn't. Max had it rough and was always a good friend. He was the sweetest, gentlest guy David had ever known. Too sweet and gentle sometimes, bawling like a baby as he read or watched movies. Women just didn't respect a guy who was more feminine than they were. But Max couldn't change his nature. And the kids sure enjoyed talking to him. He had a timeless way about him that spoke of childhood and wide-eyed innocence. They should have gone to the library first anyway, but Max would unlock the door if it was closed when they got there. Sometimes it seemed to David that Max slept at the library. They drove the few blocks across town to the public library, an old historic building always being worked on, expanded, improved. David wondered if libraries would cease to exist when Brienne was his age, everything going to digital and such. He hoped not. There was something about old books, their feel, their smell, that spoke volumes, no pun intended, about humanity's history and ideals. David parked the car right in front of the building. There were only two other cars in the parking lot, one of them Max's. He checked his watch. They were cutting it close. As they got out of the car, he said,
Let's be quick about it, in case Uncle Max has something to do.
What about us?
Mike asked, following at a distance.
What if we have something to do?
His father didn't know what he meant, but said,
Then be quick about it, please.
They entered the library. It was usually pretty quiet in there. But tonight, it was as silent as, well, as a library at night. Instead of Max Wierzbowski, there was a woman sitting behind the counter. Her back was to the front doors, her long, dark hair hanging freely in a timeless style.
Excuse me,
David said softly, not wanting to startle her. She turned, and he was the one who took a surprised breath. She was beautiful, astoundingly so, with high cheekbones and deep blue eyes with extremely long lashes. She was dressed very formally. Why not? She was in a library. In a gray blouse and navy blue suit jacket, a skirt, ringless fingers, not a hair out of place. There was something familiar about her, but David thought he would remember ever meeting a young woman this stunning. David managed, and even that was an accomplishment. Suddenly he was 14 again, finding himself face to face with a senior cheerleader in the cafeteria line. His stomach seemed to jump into his throat and tighten stranglingly at the same time. A woman like this could have anything she wanted, do anything that crossed her mind.
Yes,
she said, softly and patiently, her eyes moving to the two children and then back to their flustered father.
I tried David again. What was wrong with him?
Why couldn't he speak? He was 20 years past this stupid stammering stage in his life. He hadn't had a thunderstruck hormonal outbreak like this since before he'd gotten married. And it made him feel very small.
We're looking for Max Wierzbowski.
He actually stumbled over his friend's name, though that much might be forgiven.
Oh, yes. He was here earlier, but had to step away. My name is Lara.
She smiled a bit broader, all very pleasantly professional.
May I help you?
David swallowed. When she had said her name, it rang some kind of familiar bell in his mind. He had seen her before somewhere. Or she reminded him of someone he had seen before. Or it was just silly, stupid deja vu. Michael glanced at the woman once or twice. He wished he had some gum.
We're checking out books,
Brienne said, filling in for her father, who had gotten sick or something.
But of course you are,
the woman said kindly. David smiled and nodded, thinking he might check something out too, since he didn't have Max to shoot the breeze with. Or maybe he'd stay here and talk to the new librarian, find out where he knew her from, if anywhere.
Run along and find thy book,
Lara said to Brienne,
for the library is closing up soon.
The girl nodded, but didn't leave her father's side. David supposed he'd have to go with her. In summer and spring, they'd always had plenty of daylight to book browse by, but in late fall and winter, it got dark before the library closed. Michael was a few yards off, perusing the magazines, glancing up from time to time. David wondered how the librarian looked to his son, if he was old enough to notice her beauty and appreciate it if he recognized it.
"Don't you want to get a book?" David asked him.
The boy shrugged, either pouting or genuinely disinterested.
Max hasn't, mentioned you before, David said to the woman, finding it difficult to think of something to talk to her about. How long have you worked here?
Not long, mister.
David Hicks, he told her, trying to place her accent.
Not that she had an accent, per se, but she seemed to have a unique way of speaking.
Are you from town? You seem familiar.
I travel to and fro, David. Whence do you think you've seen me?
Whence? And had she said thy before?
Are you Pennsylvania Dutch by any chance? He asked. I had an uncle from there, and he had a similar way of talking.
Perhaps that is it,
Lara said and smiled. There were 1,000 secrets in that smile, but also 1,000 promises.
Wow, this is how it happens, David thought.
He was unable to remember if it had been like this when he first met Mike and Brienne's mother. It wasn't that the time since then had been so long. It was just that it had been rocky for so long. Michael rolled his eyes. He didn't want to go to the stupid, boring library in the first place. He had wanted to go to the video store, despite his earlier protests. But now his dad was acting like a cartoon skunk or something. Sure, the librarian had nice hair and was pretty in an old-fashioned sort of way. But his father wasn't supposed to fall in love again. Not with anybody. There was only one woman in the world, as far as Mike was concerned. And it should go double for her ex-husband. Stupid jerk that he was. It's not that Mike hated his father. I mean, he did, but he didn't really hate him. To be honest, he didn't know why he felt the way he did. But he was mostly scared of the future, and it was Dad's fault. That much was clear. Brienne pulled on her father's sleeve. She was afraid. She wanted to get her book and go to Daddy's house and read it, or watch whatever her daddy wanted to watch, even his boring movies about lawyers or spaceships. There was something wrong with the library. It always seemed big and old and shadowy, but it was especially bad tonight. Her father hesitated, like he didn't want to look away from the old woman behind the counter.
Daddy!
David tore himself away from Lara's eyes, mussing his daughter's hair.
Yeah?
Daddy, can you help me find a book?
Just get the borrowers, Brienne, her father said, smiling at the foxy librarian, hoping she'd think his relationship with his daughter was cute and not grating. And we'll finish it. She tugged on him again, wanting him down on her level.
I don't wanna. I need you to choose.
You're a big girl. You can pick one. She tugged yet again, apparently thinking her father was a rare type of belle. David obediently bent down so Bree could tell him something.
Can't you come with me?
She asked, then whispered in his ear. Lara stood from her seat, her heavy lashes batting.
What did she say?
She seemed genuinely intrigued.
David?
He looked at her sheepishly. She's, a little afraid of the Isles. The woman regarded her sympathetically.
Oh, child, what is there to be afraid of in a library?
Brienne shook her head. Her father said, Usually when we come visit, it's still light out, but it's dark early from the time change.
The what?
Lara asked, then immediately looked at Brienne again.
Be thou unafraid, child. Run along.
David glanced over at his son, loitering unhappily nearby. Mike, can you help Bree pick something?
I'm busy.
Didn't you just say you weren't going to check anything out? The boy just shrugged. 1, 2, 3. David put on a good face for the stranger. Just walk with her. Help her along, all right? Mike scowled. It was so unfair. But he went with Brienne into the children's section so she wouldn't get lost. He understood that part. Every time they came, the library was bigger, expanding, changing. He hated it. If Uncle Max wasn't so cool, he'd never have agreed to come here in the first place.
You didn't agree, Mike,
a little voice inside him said.
Yeah, well, he wouldn't have come at all.
Like you have a choice.
Why not just enjoy it?
Because he wasn't enjoying it. This was not his idea of fun, and he didn't like having to pretend he wanted to see his dad every other weekend.
You don't pretend.
Well, he doesn't have to be such a butthole. He only wants to spend time with you.
No, he doesn't. He wants to spend time with Brienne.
Amazingly, Michael felt his eyes starting to tear up. With gritted teeth, he willed the tears away. He didn't know what he felt.
If you acted more like a son instead of a comic book villain, maybe he'd want to spend time with you.
Mike, for the 1,000th time, wished the world were the way it was when he was 5, and all 4 of them lived together in a world that was not only safe, but magical. He took his sister's hand and led her down the aisle, reading the signs of each section. History, romance, arts, reference, hobbies, occult. Wow, the library was big. How could there be this many books in the world, let alone one mid-sized town? They found the children's section, and even that went on for rows and rows.
Pick something and let's go,
he told Brienne, and boredly scanned the shelves. He spied a big, hard-bound copy of Watership Down, and almost took it off the shelf. In that safe, magical time, just a couple of years before, Dad had read the entire book to him when he had the chicken pox, even doing British voices for some of the characters.
What is that?
Bree asked.
A book about rabbits, he said.
All at once, he could see Fiver and Hazel in his mind, and feel those itchy bumps and smell the medicine-y cream and hear his father's voice like it had just happened. Remembering that experience made him feel both happy and sad in a way he totally didn't like.
But it's for grown-ups,
Mike added before she could reach for it. But why? Why not have her check it out and see if Dad would read it again to both of them? Because those days were over.
Anyway, there's hardly any pictures.
Oh,
Brienne said, and went back to browsing.
David had been left alone with Laura the librarian, speaking without thinking, without planning out his words, surprising himself at what was coming out. He was aware he was babbling, but couldn't help himself. Not often, but my uncle would sometimes slip and say thee and thou from time to time. He thought back. He was an old-fashioned and really religious man. You too?
Of a sort,
she said, not looking away from David or giving him the impression she had work to do. He was never able to pick up on subtle clues from a woman, but it certainly seemed like she was interested. How many eligible men frequented libraries, anyway? I wondered if you remembered the name of the sequel to Lonesome Dove. She smiled noncommittally. Wow, what was she doing in this little city? She could be living anywhere, working in some glamorous field. She could be a movie star. He kept talking. It had a unique name, not like Return to Lonesome Dove or anything. She shook her head. Her dark brown hair moved exotically. David forged on. Did you, read that novel, Lonesome Dove? Really thick. Again, she signaled negative. Well, you remember the author's name?
No, David.
She didn't offer to look it up or give him suggestions. She just kept staring at him. He didn't know why, but instead of being attracted, her behavior made him feel uncomfortable somehow, almost disturbed, as if she was watching him behind a two-way mirror. That, be in fiction? He asked. She didn't answer or look away. You have a Western section?
Maybe,
she said. Helpful woman. She had obviously been hired for her people skills. David broke away from her gaze and stepped back from the reference desk. Was he an idiot to be distancing himself from such a beautiful, seemingly interested woman? He didn't know. He'd certainly been an idiot before. He walked away and kept himself from glancing back. Entering the aisles, he became aware of just how alone he was among all the volumes. Kids, he asked fairly quietly. Brianne, you hear me? She didn't answer, and he couldn't quite bring himself to shout. 30 years of library etiquette held him back, he supposed. Wow, there were a lot of aisles. To his right was fiction M.E. to N.A. To his left was fiction N.A. to N.Y. For a teeming metropolis, this would be a vast collection of books. What was the name of that author? Max would have known. Max was a repository of useless knowledge. Though it wasn't exactly useless right now, was it? And almost as soon as he'd thought his name, he found Max. David turned down another aisle and saw something lying on the floor in a heap. As he drew closer, he recognized two things. That it was someone's body, and that it was wearing a shirt that said, Property of the Xavier School for Gifted Youngsters. Max. David ran to his side, knelt down, then touched his friend. He didn't have to roll him over to know he was dead. There was blood around his groin and midsection, pooling in a drying circle on the library carpet. But David did turn him over, just to be sure. His friend's face was frozen in an expression of pain, his mouth agape. Though it seemed like a sick joke, his eyes had been cut out and replaced by 2 12-sided dice. While he couldn't say how he was sure, David nevertheless knew who had done this. Brianne was giving the children's book section the once-over. She had found The Trumpet of the Swan and thought she'd give that one a chance. But Daddy had mentioned The Borrowers, so she kept looking. She knew the books were in alphabetical order, but it hadn't been in the B's. Did that mean someone had already checked it out? Kids, somebody said, far away. Brianne,
Do you hear me? It was her father calling her. She walked quickly to the next aisle, where the big books were, and looked for him to her right and to her left. She should never have left Daddy, especially when Michael was being so mean to him. Now she'd find him, take his hand, and he'd find the borrower's book for her. But she was alone here, too. Through the corner of her eye, she caught movement up ahead and went forward, then down another aisle. A shadow moved on just the next row.
"Daddy?"
she asked, but when she got there, she was alone. This was an awful lot like a maze, she decided, and thought maybe she'd turn back and get Mike.
"Child."
Brianne stopped. The voice had been very low, very old, and very wet. It was a scary voice. It was a scary voice.
"I see thee, child,"
it said again. Another shadow moved from the aisle parallel to hers, moved in her direction. Michael stepped back from the vintage Hardy Boys mysteries and cocked his head. He thought he had heard Dad's voice. He stepped into another aisle. From elsewhere among the books, he heard his father say, "Brianne, you hear me?" Of course Dad would only call his sister. He had only one child left. Mike chose not to answer. For the second time that night, he felt tears come to his eyes. In rebellious frustration, he kicked at the carpet. He wished he was back at Dad's apartment, where he had left his PSP. There he could at least watch TV, though his dad didn't have cable. He thought he'd go back to Brianne's side, threaten to punch her until she picked a book, and get the hell out of this place. But Brianne wasn't where he had left her. She wasn't in the children's section at all. Maybe she had found what she was looking for and was at the desk with Dad. Maybe she had heard Dad calling her and had gone and found him. But Mike didn't think so. He almost got lost getting back to the front desk. Dad wasn't there. Neither was the pretty woman with the strange voice. Could something have happened to them? No. More likely they had gone out to the car, trying to teach him some kind of lesson. And it was after hours, so the librarian was gone from her desk to turn out the lights or something. He moved a little faster. He wouldn't like to be in here in the dark. Mike hit the front doors and rebounded off. They were locked tight. Upon closer inspection, they could only be opened with a key. Mike turned around. Something was wrong. His dad wouldn't just abandon him here, as much as he might want to. Him and Bree were in the library, among the bookshelves. As Mike stepped into the fiction section, he was amazed at how far back the rows seemed to stretch, almost to infinity. There had to be a mirror up there. No way could the library be this big. If it was, he might never find the others.
"Dad?"
he called. Then, doubling his volume,
"Brianne?"
A shadow moved behind him, and he whirled. The librarian stood there, raising her finger to her prominent red lips.
"Shh,"
she said. It sounded like gas escaping from a tank.
"This is a library,"
she added uselessly.
"There's nobody here. Library's closed."
"Not closed entirely,"
she said and grinned.
"Where's my..."
But Michael stopped. The librarian's teeth were completely black, as if made of burnt wood. She continued to grin, her eyes widening, wider, wider, till her eyeballs threatened to pop from their sockets. Mike ran. His friend dead at his feet, David turned to get back to his children. Lara, the librarian, stood in the aisle, silently blocking his way.
She was wearing a gray miniskirt, slit up the side, and high heels, her bare legs slightly apart. Gulp. Lara noticed him noticing and smiled again. She knew how long it had been.
"Not as long as it had been for Uncle Maxwell here,"
she whispered, glancing past David at the dead body on the floor. She shook her head.
"Poor Blinkered might have still laid with me, had he known who I am."
David swallowed.
"Who are you?"
She smiled again, wider this time. And suddenly, David knew who she was. Holy God, she was Jean Tierney, the dead actress from the 40s. The star of Laura.
"A notch slow, sir,"
she said, taking a step forward. Michael ran around a corner and nearly hit an endless tray of card catalogs. He doubled back, unsure where the woman was, or even what she was. She was really scary, no matter her origin. He stopped in the religion section, trying to collect his thoughts. That woman was evil, some kind of witch or monster. Mike didn't know why he hadn't noticed it from the beginning. The way she looked at his dad like he was made of chocolate and she hadn't eaten all day. But he had been too angry, in a bad mood just for bad mood's sake, to pick up on it.
"Damn it,"
Michael said, and tried hard to figure out what he should do. He couldn't get out the door. The windows were up too high, and he didn't know the place well enough to head for a back exit. Even if he could get away, he couldn't just leave Brienne and his dad.
I thought you hated him. "Shut up," Mike said to himself.
The rows were longer than they had been before, and the racks were now over his head. It was expanding, growing. She had turned this place into some kind of maze. Could he maybe get to a phone and call for help? What would he say if he found one? If the phone even worked in here? What else could he do? What could he use as some sort of weapon? All there were was books. How could a book help him? She was approaching. David knew he had to do something to not end up like Max. Maybe he could fight this person, though that didn't seem like a wise choice. Perhaps he could talk his way out of this, find out who she was, other than a decades dead movie star, that is. Or maybe he should just turn and run. Running sounded infinitely preferable. But fight, talk, or run, he couldn't let Lara get to him. He had to get away, go anywhere, do anything. Anything except stand here stupidly as the woman creature got nearer and nearer to him.
"Share thy heart with me, David,"
Lara said, but held no doubt that he would. Closing the distance, she licked her shiny red lips and opened her arms. David continued to stand where he was. Mike came around the corner and stopped. A few rows up, his father was embracing some sort of black thing. It only looked vaguely human now, and female only in its smaller, thinner stature. As the boy neared them, he could see the rotting, diseased flesh of the thing, and his father's arms around it, even sticking into its putrid blackness. He couldn't tell if Dad was kissing or hugging it, only that his fingers would splay and twitch every couple of seconds, as if he was getting jolts of electric shock from it. He didn't know what it was doing to Dad. He only knew he had to save him. He advanced. David was not enjoying himself, though he had but for a moment. To be held, to be touched, embraced after so long, by someone so strong and so beautiful. It was like a cool cloth on a fevered brow, a sweet swallow of wine to a parched throat. Or love to the lovelorn, hope to the hopeless.
"Oh,"
he managed, as their bodies separated for the briefest of seconds. But even that was too long apart. He needed Laura, needed her touch, her love, more than he needed anything, even to breathe. But her name wasn't Laura, and she wasn't kissing or loving him. What was that in his nose, covering his eyes, down his throat? Was he bleeding? He could feel something going out of him, something he needed. And when he tried to open his eyes, there was pain. The dull, aching pain of a cracked rib or smashed finger. He tried to moan, but no air was in his lungs. Something else was. Something like tar. Something like excrement. Something corrupt.
Mike,
he tried to call.
Brianne!
But he couldn't call out. He had somehow slipped over his head into black quicksand. He was dying. Slowly dying. Michael gripped the Bible with both hands, as tightly as he could. He wasn't sure if this would work. They never said anything about monsters in Sunday school, but he hoped that it would. He prayed that it would. His father made that tiny, gurgling, mewling sound again, and Mike struck. He swung the Bible at the witch woman with all of his might. When the book hit her in the small of her back, you would have thought she'd been shot by a pirate ship's cannon. There was a thunderous crash. The woman shrieked, and fire burst out of the holy book, engulfing both the woman and the shelf beside her in flames. David fell away from her, gagging and gasping for breath at the same time. The howling woman thing ran, her back and hair aflame. She fled down the aisle, leaving fiery droplets of herself in her wake. David had dropped to his knees. He thought he'd surely pass out, but he was all right, it seemed. Or soon would be.
Dad,
Mike said, helping his father to his feet. David coughed, feeling liquid oozing from both of his nostrils. He wiped it away with his sleeve, expecting it to come off red, or worse, black. But it appeared to be only mucus. He looked at Mike with watery, aching eyes. The boy was gripping something tightly, a charred half a book.
Mikey,
he said, and put his arms around the boy. That's when David realized his hands were burned. He didn't feel anything now, but there was redness all down them and some blistering on his fingers. Mike put the destroyed Bible on the floor and hugged his father back, and it was as if the last year and a half had never happened.
Dad,
he said, and found himself crying for the third time. This time, he let the tears come. David groaned and looked around him. Already the fire was spreading down the fiction section. It was like it was made of paper or something. He still felt groggy and weak, and Mike saw that he didn't seem to know entirely what was going on. He grabbed his father's arm.
We gotta go, Dad.
A fire alarm went off somewhere in the building, but no sprinklers turned on. Guess you wouldn't want to water damage all the old books, eh?
Where's your sister?
Mike also looked around.
She ran away or something.
Brianne!
They started moving toward the front of the library. David looked behind them, in case Laura was creeping up again, but there was only smoke and flickering bookshelves. They moved faster.
Brianne!
He shouted, fear and shame in his voice. Despite the unusual circumstances, he couldn't help but feel this was his fault. He shouted again, louder, panic and tears equally close to the surface. He inhaled smoky air to call a third time, when his daughter appeared right in their path. Mike actually ran into her. Bree was fine, but looked terrified, her big eyes wide with confusion. He couldn't blame the girl. She embraced her father, and he scooped her up in burned arms to carry her toward the exit.
"Don't look back, honey,"
David said, but he was more scared of what he would see if he did. His daughter's head was buried in his chest, and she couldn't see anyway. He thought Laura was back there somewhere, singed but alive,
and wouldn't let them escape so easily. Row after row after row after row they ran, David's chest tight and his arms aching. They had gone so far through the endless library that the air was clear here. Mike said, "The doors are locked," as they finally emerged from the shelves and saw their path, past the computer terminals, copy machines, and checkout counter up ahead. But when David hit the front door, it opened just fine. In fact, they were the kind of doors that only locked from the outside. The boys started to explain that before they hadn't been like that, but Dad just kept going. The three of them burst out into the crisp, cold night. David went straight for the car, but Mike looked back, expecting to see an inferno straight out of that Armageddon movie. There was no evidence of a fire within, no smoke, no flames, not even a flickering orange light. Nor was there a monstrous face spying at them from the windows. It was really quite calm, non-threatening. Just a library. And a small one, too. 2 floors, half a city block shared with the Civic Center. David opened the front door. They hadn't locked the car, and unloaded Brianne gently onto the passenger seat. He ran around to the driver's side, glancing back to see that his son was climbing in with no problems.
"You okay, Mike?"
The boy nodded, slamming the door behind him. David sat down, sticking the keys in the ignition. Not thinking, he said, "Seat belts," as he started the engine. He also locked the doors, just in case. They pulled out of the parking lot, passing Max's old Pontiac. Poor Uncle Max. David wondered how much of the library would burn. He wondered if Max's body would be discovered and identified. He wondered if his friend would be blamed for the fire. As if reading his mind, Mike spoke up from the back seat.
"Dad, if the whole library burns down, will people think we did it?"
"I don't know, son," David said.
He hadn't considered that, but wasn't willing to worry about it now.
"I'm just glad we made it out."
Maybe he should have dragged Max's body out with them. It seemed wrong to leave him there in the building to burn. But he had loved the library, Uncle Max. David thought back to the last conversation he had with him. He wondered if the rare book he had told him about was also destroyed in the fire. Maybe. Maybe not. He hoped so, though. The car stereo was going, playing Landslide by Fleetwood Mac. David turned the volume down. As they reached Lincoln Avenue, they could hear sirens in the distance. Up ahead, a fire truck could be seen, red lights flashing.
"How about you, honey?"
David asked, looking over at his daughter.
"Worry thou not, all is well,"
she said quietly. David turned the radio all the way off.
"What, honey?"
"Nothing, Daddy,"
Brianne said. The end.
Okay, so that was Library Week.
W-E-A-K? Question mark.
See, a part of me is just tempted to trash all of this and say, no, we're doing it as a Doonstief episode, because, gosh, I would just love to talk with Big for 20 minutes about video stores, about the rise and fall of the American video store. And that, when I said the story was when I said the story was dated, it was about because of that, you know? The dad takes his kids to a video store at the very beginning. Then, it, you know, the rest of the story takes place at the library, which is kind of unchanging. I didn't mention the Dewey Decimal System or anything like that, which would make it more dated. I wrote this in 2005, same year as Birth of a Sidekick, and this was getting close to the end of my stay in Los Angeles. I'm sure this wasn't the last story that I wrote in LA. It's not a Los Angeles-centric story anyway. But I tended to write two kinds of stories. They were the small town America ones and then Los Angeles stories. And I haven't shared a lot of the Los Angeles stories just because, I don't know, they don't speak to me like small town ones do. But even then, even in 2005, the video store was on its way out. There were lots of contributing factors, but I would say that Netflix was probably the biggest blow struck against the video store. When you could just look online and decide, oh, this looks good, and add it to your queue, and it would come to your house, and there were no late fees, and you never had to drive across town to return it. That was the bell tolling. Who does it toll for? Tolls for the Blockbuster Video and Hollywood Video, which is the one I think that gets referred to in this. And then also, they came out with this thing called the Red Box, which is a little DVD kiosk that they have at, like, pharmacies and grocery stores. And the video store was already circling the drain, as they say, when Redbox came to be. But the three contributing factors, I would say, would be Netflix streaming on the internet and Redbox. It's not something the video store could combat. But oh, the video store, for such a small window in time, was a magical place. It's a place that I remember with fondness. And I worked at a video store. Big Anklevich worked at a video store. My buddy Ian worked at a video store. You know, maybe Big Anklevich didn't work there. I don't know. Yeah, in the pre-internet days, it was a major way of spending your time, of having a good time, of something that you did. You know, the video arcade had an even smaller window. And yeah, I know video arcades still exist. Here's the thing, dude. Video stores still exist. Big and I, we went on a road trip just a couple weeks ago, and there we drove through this little town out in the middle of BFE, and they had a video store. And I was like, wow, I should stop and go there. And my uncle moved out to Hemet, California, which is this retirement community out in the middle of nowhere. Trying to find his house inspired a couple of stories where he's just... They're very isolated, and they had two video stores. They still have two video stores. And every once in a while, I mean, I don't go there very much, but every once in a while I'll drive through that town and I'll see the two video stores and I'll just be like, oh, wow, that is just cool. There is one video store in the county I live in, and they did a write-up on it in the newspaper, and I read the article where the guy had said, you know, we opened in 1985 or something like that, and we've seen all our competitors come and go, and we've been on the ropes a few times. We started selling, like, prepaid cell phones and crystal meth and energy drinks and things like that, and that's kept us afloat. But, yeah, we're still here, and people come from miles away to go to the video store and bring their kids and sigh and tell them about, okay, I don't know that people come from miles away, and people certainly don't bring their kids. It was just a staple of the 80s. And then, yeah, in the 90s, when I came of age or whatever you want to call it, it was a weekend activity. It was something that I looked forward to going to. And there were so many different video stores. And yeah, if you wanted a new release, sure, go to Hollywood or go to Blockbuster because they were guaranteed to have them. But if you wanted something obscure, if you wanted something that you'd never heard of, it was best to go to the mom and pop ones that had been around forever, because they'd still have video cassettes that they got in 81, 82, 83, that kind of stuff. And for looking for like obscure horror movies from the late 70s and early 80s, yeah, that was the thing to do. That was the place to go. It was really cool. And one by one, at the end of the 20th century, they disappeared. They closed one at a time. And I remember going with my buddy Jeff to one that was closing, and we bought a ton of horror movies that we'd never seen so that we could review them, because they were just clearing them out. It's like, oh, here's $2 a piece or whatever it is. And After we watched him, I think I sold several of those, and, you know, I'd make $4 or $5 a piece on some of them. And so, you know, that was a good memory, too. I mean, I have bad memories, too. I mean, Blockbuster was notorious for their fudging late fees. In fact, that, you know, they had a class action lawsuit, and around 2003 or 4, they came up with a new policy, and, you know, no more late fees, and all your late fees are forgiven, and come back to us. And by then, Blockbuster was in trouble. They knew it. The writing was on the wall. And I remember being in college, and I'd rented a copy of The Shining, Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, and watched it and returned it. And I don't know, like a week later, a week and a half later, I got a call, and it was early in the morning. To me, it was like 3 in the morning, but it was probably like 9:15 or something like that, and it was Blockbuster Video. I said, oh, hey, what's going on? And the guy was such a dick. He said, I think you know what's going on. And I said, well, no, to me, it's early in the morning. You'll have to explain what's going on. He's like, The Shining. I said, oh, yeah, The Shining is a... Wait, what about it? He said, you didn't return The Shining. I'm just calling because it's been 10 days after that long week call to remind you. Late fees are racking up. And I said, oh, geez, dude, I returned that the first day it was due. I wasn't late at all on that. In fact, I haven't been to your store since then. And he's like, I returned it. Well, you must have returned it to another store or something like that. And I said, oh, geez, well, can you check? And so he put me on hold and he went out and checked. Now, it would have been easy for him to just put me on hold for 2 minutes and then pick up and say, nope, not there. But he actually went and checked, and it was right there on the shelf in horror. And he said, oh, yeah, it was on the shelf. So you did return it. And I said, oh, okay, well, and he's like, all right, thanks. And he hung up. I didn't get an apology or anything. And I was just like, wow, that sucked. And, you know, went back to sleep or whatever. But the next time I went to that Blockbuster and tried to check something out, they had late fees racked up. It says you had The Shining 10 days overdue. And I said, oh, no, I wasn't late on that. They didn't check it in. It was just on the shelf, and they never checked it in until that day. I told the story, and they're like, oh, okay. Well, do you want to pay these late fees, or do you? And I was like, no, you need to wipe out those late fees. And they said, well, I can't do that. We can get the manager. And I said, okay. He's on lunch. And I was just like, oh, come on. Can I check this out? And it's like, not without paying your late fees. And I never went to that Blockbuster again. Because, of course, in those days, there were 100 different options for video stores. And I don't know why I'm telling you that story. I'm going to say that was the fourth thing that contributed to the downfall of the video store, though, was the late fees. People just hated the late fees. And there must have been an issue for them to have a class action lawsuit. There must have been. Because that's not something that happens with one person. It's usually something that happens with a whole party of people that write their names down and say, hey, I was wronged too. I want a piece of that. It's funny, though, that that's what I would focus on, and that's what I would want to focus on with Big Anklevich, with, you know, just the video store, the experience of video stores, working in a video store, all that stuff. Because Library Week is not about that. It is about a library. Actually, what it's about is that same year, I wrote a story called Father's Day in August. And it was about a dad. I don't know if he was divorced or not. He was alone. And he had taken his little boy to a carnival. The carnival that they have in Praisden, where... I'm trying to remember what they have. It's Pickle Days. They have Praisden Pickle Days every year in August. And it's like their hometown celebration. And they have booths and dancing and fireworks and carnival rides. And I wrote a couple of stories in 2000 about the Praisden Pickle Days Carnival. And I really, really enjoyed writing about it. I got this idea that, like, some of the rides, there was something evil about the rides, or that some of the carnies, or whatever you want to call them, are evil. And I enjoyed writing that. And so I said, okay, I'll do a third one. And a dad took his son to the, what do they call the scary place, the scary ride? A dad took his son in one of those rides, and something takes the son. And for that story to work, I had to have the son be absolutely perfect and loving and well worth fighting for. You know, I didn't have any kids when I wrote that story. But I just, yeah, I thought the closer, tighter bond the dad and the son have, you know, the more compelling it will be when he loses the son. I don't know that story turned out all that great. I've never shared it with anybody, maybe? I don't know. But then later on, I got this idea of a dad with his kids, a divorced dad with his kids, having some kind of supernatural experience. And I thought, well, I'm going to make it the opposite. And so I had the son, I think his name was Michael, be just the worst, the opposite of that little boy in Father's Day in August. Sullen and resentful and spoiled. Basically what I imagine everybody in the millennial generation was as a kid or is. Although that term didn't exist then. Big Anklevich introduced me to the term millennial. And because of the way he introduced me to it, I still have super negative connotations in my mind of that word. There's just no positive, there's no such thing as a positive form of millennial. It's like gold digger or something like that. Maybe in 1930, there was such a thing as a positive gold digger, but not now. Anyhow, why did I say, oh, so that's sort of where this story came from. What? Oh, the other thing was, every year, starting in 2000, every year, my friend Jeff would challenge me to write an October scary story. And back when he was a writer, he would do it too. And so for the first two or three years of the 21st century, Jeff and I would write a scary-ish story in October. And then he stopped writing. But I continued the tradition. And in 2005, it was the fifth year in a row that I wrote one, and this was it. I'm sure I missed a few years here and there. My writing is kind of like a roller coaster, and there are high points and there are pretty low points. And there's a loop in there, which is really strange. But I did one in 2016, so I've done them recently. But yeah, this was part of that tradition, Library Week. And something that I tried in this story that I hadn't really done before was I would jump from point of view to point of view. And I've been told that you're not supposed to do that, and it's a flaw in my writing. And as I was narrating this, I recognized that it was there. But I just, you know, I wrote what I wrote when I created this little story. And you could do a rewrite that smooths it out or changes it so that there's not that thing called head hopping. But I'm not going to do that. I honestly didn't feel like it hurt the story at all to do the thing. You know, I heard an audiobook narrator just this month actually change his tone of voice for each chapter, depending on who the point of view chapter was. And I didn't realize he was doing it until I heard him kind of, he was doing a higher pitched voice, a softer voice while he was narrating. And I thought, whoa, whoa, what happened here? This is the same guy. And then I realized that the point of view character was a woman, and he was sort of doing that chapter in a woman's voice. And then later, there was a point of view that was a kid, and he did the chapter talking like this, reading the chapter. And I was just like, whoa, I've never heard that before with an audiobook. And I don't know that I liked it. You know, the narrator is the narrator, and he should just be the same voice all through. And he changes the voice for the characters' dialogue and for their thoughts. But Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that is something that people do, audiobook narrators do, and I just never picked up on it before. I don't know that I would ever do it. Like, you get a chapter and there's a British narrator, so all of a sudden I start talking like this. And it's like, blimey, there's something wrong with this bleeding lift. Have I left my other keys in the boot of my car? Boy, this is terrible. Wait, see, that's dialogue. And that was meant to be a joke because it wasn't a British accent. Sorry, if I explain the joke, then that means it wasn't funny. Okay, library week. We had single dad. Bing. We had geek best friend. Bing. We had shapeshifter. Bing. As the villain. I really like shapeshifters, kids. And then we had evil child, right? Bing. So lots of... this was a Rish Outfield's greatest hits kind of thing. I don't know that there were any Star Wars references in there. But there was a Back to the Future reference. And Aliens reference. And brought up Lonesome Dove. Yeah, just very obviously a story written by me. And there were a couple of moments that I thought worked pretty well. I forgot to have the chorus of undead, shape-shifting children say,
"It's not a great story."
Maybe I'll do that in a scary voice.
"It's not a great story."
But I'm not going to do that on this one. I don't know that the story is bad. If we'd shared it on the Doonstief, many, 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 many more people would have heard it if that episode had come out. You never know. I got an email just yesterday from one of the authors that sold a story to us. And he's like, "Hey, you didn't run my story. Can I just submit it someplace else?" And it bummed me out a little bit because I edited that particular story January, probably. But it also bummed me out because of course you can submit it someplace else. Of course you can. That's fine. You know, we don't ask for anything exclusive unless it's for a contest. And even then, I think it's exclusively ours until we run it. And then you can run it somewhere else. But I wouldn't even care if somebody wrote something for a Broken Mirror contest of ours and then they put it on their website or Clone Pod ran it or something. I don't know. Yeah, it just, I guess that's what I was thinking, is would it have been better had it been run on the Doonstief? Well, obviously, to have a female voice for Lara would have been nice. Would we have had kid voices for the two kids? I think we wouldn't have, not at this point. The only difference would have been Lara's voice, and then we would have had one of us narrate, me narrate, and Big B, David, or vice versa. And I don't know that would have made the story any better or worse. I guess we would have had... Well, I would have ended up editing it. So it would have sounded almost exactly like it sounds right now. Just more people would have heard it in 2019. I don't know if it was a mistake or not. There are more stories that can be run on the Doonstief. And if the show starts really firing again on all cylinders like it was at one point, then I'll start producing stories for the Doonstief again. And it'll be great. It would have been nice to have Big for this conversation, to share a video store story or three. I remember his buddy Ian used to always talk about working at a video store somewhere in Sacramento, I think, and they got this movie in called Edward Penis Hands. And boy, Ian could not let that go. He would bring up Edward Penis Hands almost as much as I bring up the great Chicago fire of the 1880s. Anyhow, I'm going to hang up now like I'm on a phone call with you. Isn't that weird? I appreciate you listening to the Rish Outcast. I appreciate you supporting me on Patreon if you do. If you don't, I still appreciate you listening to my show. You know how few people listen to this show? You're among the elite. There will be more episodes to come. And I hope you're there. Heck, I hope I'm there. Take care.
The music in today's episode was presented by Kevin MacLeod of the website Incompetech.com.
Like it or not, the Rish Outcast is presented under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. While it hurts to say, that means you can't alter, sell, or claim ownership of the file. But you can download it, share it, and grind it to bits under your heavy boots, free of charge. There's also a Patreon fund attached to it, if you've lost hold of your senses and want to encourage more of the show. You can donate $1 an episode and up, or just contribute monthly to Outfield's daft schemes. In return, he presents exclusive content, as well as early access to the episodes. You still here? Well, get out there and get on with your day. You think the bad guys are going to stomp themselves? Thus endeth the lesson.
The other warning is that it sucks. Should I cut that out or should I leave that in? Flip a coin. Oh, Lord, it landed on its side. Okay, that means both. So I'll use it as an outtake, and I'll come up with a substitute.